Okay, thanks everyone for coming. We are plugging away at Megillas Esther, and even though I thought we had so much time before Purim, there are 10 prakim, and with each section there's so much to discuss. So we think we have 1 week more. We're in the seventh parak, which is it describes the downfall of Haman, and then believe it or not, the story actually continues. We think, okay, Haman off with his head. And then that's it. Though there are events that follow, some complications that follow as well. So maybe we'll do, not sure yet, we'll do next week, some pre-Purim topic, either Megillah or maybe other sort of Purim topics. But Yirtzeh Hashem, it'll be years to come when we can fill in some of the gaps that we didn't get to this year. Okay, so the seventh parak discusses the downfall of Haman. That know that Haman had received approval to be able to, at least it was his intention was to annihilate the Jewish people. We'll see there was maybe a misunderstanding from Achashverosh about what exactly Haman's plan was. But Haman certainly intended to kill the Jews. The Jews realized that. Esther approached the king, and the king said, I'll give you any request, even if you want half the kingdom. And Esther requested that the king and Haman come to a banquet. And that's where we begin now. The parak begins, Vayovo Melech v'Haman lishtosim Esther amalka. That the king and Haman went to a feast with Esther the queen. And the king assumed that she had a request. The king said to Esther on the second day during the wine feast, Mashe Lasech Esther Amalka, what's your request? And I'll give it to you, Ma Bakashasek, and what's your request? Ad Chatzi Amalkus B'teyas. Even if it's half the kingdom, that shall be done. And this conversation begins the outing of Haman. But like other sections in the Megillah, the conversation is not necessarily as direct as it could be. And you want to take a look and figure out what exactly everyone's saying and why they're saying it, how they're saying it. And Esther continues to tell Achashverosh in Pasuk Gimel, Vitan Esther Amalka, that Esther replied and said, But Tomer, she said, Imat Sasi Fin Beinecha, if I found favor in your eyes, a melech, Imal a melech tov, and if it's good with the king, Tinasin li nafshi b'she'ilasi v'ami b'vakashasi. That give me my, may my life be given me in my petition and my people in my request. Okay, it's a dramatic way of opening. So what is she? I imagine if you're Achashverosh, you're thinking, okay, so what is she getting at? She says, Kinim karnu aniva amila shmi laharo galabed, for we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed and obliterated. And if we were going to be sold as slaves and maidservants, hecharashti, I would have been silent, I wouldn't have made such a fuss. Ki einat sar shove benezek hamelech, and the enemy, the adversary, has no consideration for the king's loss. So, what is she trying to tell Achashverosh? In particular, she says, if we had just been slated to be sold as slaves, I would have remained silent. Also, she says, Kim karnu ani ve'ami lahashmi laharo galabed, that we have been sold, I and my people. She puts herself before the rest of the Jewish people. And this is, I think, reflecting what Mordechai tells Esther before, that don't think that you're going to be spared. But presumably Haman didn't know that Esther is part of the Jewish people, but she emphasizes that she is slated for annihilation along with her people. And she said it had only been a decree to be sold into slavery, I would have remained silent. I would have made a fuss. So what is she getting at? I just noted that the Aramaic Targum, when it says Ta'an Esther, it translated as Uzkafas Esther Yasein Noha Klape Shmaya, that Esther raised her eyes towards heaven in tefillah. So all throughout this, there was a recognition of Hashem's imminent presence. But why did she say, I would have remained silent? I wouldn't have made such a fuss. What's she trying to do?
She's trying to put a monetary value on the Jewish people. Because she's saying, if we were slaves, we'd still have a monetary value. But by destroying us, we lose everything.
Well, she's right. She's saying, oh, I would have remained silent. I wouldn't have said anything had the decree just been that we would all be sold as slaves. Susan Meeting is added.
Trying to value them more to the king, because the king would have received money or taxes on the selling of slaves, but not on the destruction of the people.
Right. So the destruction of the people wouldn't have been advantageous to him. The Al-Sheikh and Rashi actually say just that. Is she's saying, if this enemy was acting in your best interest and he was going to sell us as slaves, so I wouldn't have made a fuss about that, because, you know, that's okay. You're the king. You're allowed to have slaves. You know, we're okay with that. But she says, ki ein atzar shove benezek hamelech, that the adversary has no consideration for the king's loss. That he just has his own, you know, crazy plans of annihilation, but that's not going to benefit the king. And the Malbim really breaks down her dialogue, the way she phrases it. She says that, one, she says that the essential sale was for her. She emphasizes the fact, which is true, but she's also trying, I think, to make a more powerful, compelling case to the king that really, Shikar Machira Haisa Bavura, Shikar Machshava's Haman Haya La'abed Osa, that the essential sale was for her, because Haman's essential plot was to destroy her.
Can you slow it, see if the heat is high, because it feels very hot. Could you lower it to like 60 something?
Haman's essential plot was to destroy her. And then, as an extension, she's also going to, he also is going to destroy her entire nation. But she emphasizes the fact that she is the prominent figure who's slated for destruction. And also, all we know is that Ahasuerus consented to some vague petition from Haman about this people. They're Mefuzer and Mefora, they're scattered, they're separate, they don't do the king any good, and basically, you know, let me do what I want with him. But it's not clear that it was spelled out to Ahasuerus what exactly the decree was. And the Malbim and others point out that was exactly the claim that she was making to indict Haman, is Haman deceived you as far as what he was asking for. Because when it's said that, one, she's revealing to him that they weren't going to be sold as slaves, it's presumably she thought that Ahasuerus assumed that when there was this decree against the people, so you enslave them, you don't allow them to have their independence, their any rights, and they're just treated as property for your benefit. So that's presumably what Ahasuerus thought. And she then clarified that Haman had tricked the king in two ways. One, by saying, when he says Yeshu am echad, that there's one people, there's a particular people, Stamam built him with Mephorsam. He just referred to a anonymous nation, and the implication is that this nation isn't so significant. You know, but the Jews were prominent. They were disliked, but they weren't just some random anonymous nation. So that's number one. And And number two, when it says, let it be written abdam to destroy them. So what did it mean to destroy them? It doesn't say to kill them, to execute them. It's that Haman said back in the third parak that the Jews have different laws. You know, they do their own thing. Sakashverosh was agreeing to find a way to get them to abandon their laws. You know, he would outlaw their particular religious practices, but it wasn't that Achashverosh wanted to or consented to wiping out an entire population of people. He says he wanted to destroy, the Mavi says he wanted to destroy the Hashem, they wanted to destroy the nation and its laws. And she said that he'd only tricked the king in one matter, not revealing who the nation was, then I would have been silent and I wouldn't have revealed him. I wouldn't have started up. But because the decree was already released. But now that the entire decree, you know, if there's one part that's a little bit vague, so then maybe it wasn't clear enough. And you can't necessarily assert that he was trying to deceive the king. But now that you have these two aspects, that he didn't let the king know what nation it was, and that he wasn't clear about what he intended to do, then I saw that the whole thing was a product of deceit. And just put in the chart here that the Malbim breaks down these different phrases. When he says, when Esther says, "Kinim karno aniva v'ami," that I and my nation have been sold, meaning Haman is trying to harm me. He's trying to harm me, and my nation is not insignificant. And when it says to destroy, that was Haman's actual plan, but he lied to you because he gave you the impression that all he intended to do was to sell us as slaves. And had we been sold, so it's your kingdom, it's your law, and I wouldn't have said anything. But now that I see that Haman was trying to deceive you, I'm coming to protect you. And Esther has to be shrewd, and she definitely was. He was not only presenting this to Achashverosh, expecting that he would be sympathetic to her. She already knew that Achashverosh didn't really have that reputation of, even though it seemed at this point he was about to be very generous to Esther. But she's really, her case is that, look what Haman did to you. He deceived you. He was gonna cause you a big loss. And then that's why the pasuk says. Say that's why, right? Ki ein hatzar shove ben ezek hamelech, that the enemy is not has no consideration for the king's loss. And the Alshech explains that he would harm the Jews, as Mindy said, by causing him to lose the revenue from the taxes and the duties that the Jewish population was paying him. You know, they were, you know, law-abiding, tax-paying citizens, and they just to wipe out an entire population doesn't really help the king. It certainly doesn't enrich the king. And Rashi says, "Ge'ein hatzar shove ben ezek hamelech," that the adversary has no consideration for the king's laws. That ein choshev ben ezek hamelech, he has no concern for the king's laws. Because if he sought your benefit, even if he was pursuing your benefit, he would have said, "Mechora osam labadim lishakos, sell them as male servants and females, male slaves and female slaves, the kavala mamon, and receive the money, or keep them for yourselves, and they'll be your slaves." So that's Esther's pitch to Achashverosh, that I'm only coming to you for your benefit. If it was just about us, if it was just about me, I wouldn't have said anything. This is your kingdom. These are your laws. But look what he's trying to do to you. And you see, that's why Achashverosh responded so angrily. The Mamloes puts another angle to Esther's line that had we only been slated to be sold as slaves, I would have remained silent. That not that she would have kept quiet had they been sold as slaves, but she wouldn't have rushed to approach the king, meaning she's doing this very suddenly, very abruptly. And if it wasn't so urgent, she wouldn't have brought this up now. So according to this angle, it was a justification for her being so forward about this matter, that if it wasn't something that was so urgent, so we could have put it on the table, we could have had a good time at the feast, but because this is so urgent, I have to bring it up. And then the question is, so why was Achashverosh surprised? And he sounds like he doesn't know what's going on. In source number 7, +5, he says, Vayomer HaMelech Achashverosh, Vayomer LeEsther, King Achashverosh said, and he said to Esther, we'll look at why it says said twice, Mi huzeh ve'ezehu asher melo libo lasos kein. Who is this and where is he who dared to do this? Well, you know that Haman was the second in command who tried to get you to approve a decree to do something to someone. What else was he thinking about? He said there's someone in your kingdom who's planning to destroy us. Well, Achashverosh presumably would have known about it. Everything goes through him. So what's he so surprised about? Especially if he needs a reminder, Haman's right there. Oh, you remember that when I, gave you the approval. So the Abderav, the Ov Yisrael in number 8, points out something that others do as well. The word la'avdam and la'avdam are pronounced the same. So Haman had requested Achashverosh's authorization to enslave the Jews, la'avdam. You mind, Haman was, saying this. This angle, Haman was saying this to Achashverosh, la'avdam, we should be ma'aved these people. So Achashverosh thought that, great, we can enslave a people, they can be our property, they can be useful to us. But then when he wrote it down, he changed it to la'avdam with an aleph. And that's how it was publicized. I was thinking that it's a Hasidic interpretation, but it could be that in the Persian, the language they spoke, there was also a way that they could relate the two words. But that's a good point. I was just thinking the same thing. It says that the Abderav of says that Haman changed the letters in the written decree. And again, she was presenting this as being for the best interest of the king and her being concerned for him. He says, had we just been decreed to be sold into slavery, so she would have kept quiet. But the king's words were changed. How dare someone change the king's words, change what to try to manipulate what the king agreed to. And when he was saying, Mi yuzeh ve'ezeh who is this? Where is the one who dared to do this? He's saying, who changed the wording of my decree? Who tried to manipulate the permission that I gave? So that's why he's asking, that's why he sounds surprised, because sure, he knew that Haman was the one who made this petition and he had approved. But now, Esther, you're telling me that he wants to annihilate your entire people from, young and old, children, infants. So who was the one who did that? And that's why he was so angry that someone had changed his words. And just to note, it says, look up in number 7, Vayomer HaMelech HaKashverosh, Vayomer LeEsther HaMalka. So it says, and Vayomer and Vayomer, why does it say it twice? So Rabbi Abahu in the Gemara says that initially Esther spoke, Ahasuerus spoke to Esther through a translator who would interpret on his behalf. I guess their relationship wasn't so close that, they wouldn't have, sound like they have deep conversations. She thought that, here's this common woman from this nation that nobody knows about. She presumably doesn't know, since she doesn't know English, but she doesn't know whatever the language that they spoke. So we have the good thing, we have a translator. But once she told him that she came from the house of Sheol, this sounds like this was all kind of revealed in her revelation to Ahasuerus about her nation. Then he realized that Esther was from royal stock. And that's why it says again. So first, by Yomar Melech Ahasuerus, first he was speaking to the translator. Then he realized that she was from the tribe of Binyamin, from the house of Sheol. And then it says, by Yomar Le Esther Amalka, he spoke directly to Esther the queen. And what about Haman? Did Haman know that Esther was Jewish?
I don't know. Didn't he know she was related to
me? Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mordecai didn't Mordecai get the tzitzit, right?
Right. Well, she didn't reveal it to Ahasuerus. So the Gemara says in number 11 that it at least indicates that Haman did not know, and that in general people didn't know, because the pasuk says, "But he Esther no says chayin," that Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who looked upon her. And Rabbi Lazar says that Milamed Shalakol Echad Be'echad Nidmisa Lo Ke'umaso, that she somewhat presented herself as if she was from their nation.
It says,
it's clear she didn't tell, right?
It was Mordecai's instruction.
Right.
She was speaking a language that was not.
No, well, they knew many languages.
Wasn't local. Yeah, but then she was probably speaking Hebrew and not.
But they lived in Persia, Mordecai and Esther.
No, the question is, what was the
translator? What was he translating?
I don't think he knew where she was from. She could have. They went out to the entire kingdom. She could have been from, India. She could have been from somewhere else. He was in fact local, but he didn't know that, because they didn't reveal the Mordecai and Esther in particular didn't reveal to him. So it sounds like at this point Ahasuerus had no idea who she was, and it sounds like from the Gemara that Haman as well, and that in general people didn't know Esther's origin, because she was so charismatic that she would be able to relate to everyone as if she was from their nation. Maybe she kept some distance from Ahasuerus, but in general, everyone thought, who is this Esther? We don't know where she's from. Oh, seems like she's from my nation. No, she's one of us. So presumably Haman didn't know, because no one really knew. She was able to convince everyone that she was one of them. And another question that comes up is, why doesn't Haman defend himself? He said, Esther says, up to number 10, but Tomer Esther, Ish Sarva Oyeg, this is man who's an adversary and an enemy, Haman Hara Hazeh, the wicked Haman. This is the Haman Nivas Milifnei HaMelech HaMalka. And Haman cringed in terror before the king and the queen. Why didn't Haman try to defend himself, speak up for himself? He was obviously a...
Because there was proof. He changed the wording in the... What's it called? Sefer, the official book.
Yeah, but then the decree, yeah.
If there was actual proof.
Right, the gallows as well.
Right, the gallows were there, but...
And king and the queen were very united.
Right. So it would...
He was the third
wheel. I know. You wonder what was going on. Well, that's what we saw last time, that Ahasuerus was suspicious. So already he you know, was suspicious of Haman. But isn't Haman convinced Ahasuerus before? He's just by saying they're this nation, they're not doing you any good. No, I would think that Haman and Ahasuerus were closer than Ahasuerus and Esther. I think Ahasuerus was being very nice to Esther. He's probably very nice to, you know, all of his wives or concubines who, you know, who he interacted with when he interacted with them. But Haman, you know, Haman's his right-hand man. You would think that Haman could say she's making it up or she's also one of that. He could probably do something.
Just marched Mordecai around.
Right. So it was already getting a little bit demoralized. So the Malbim says that Haman had a problem. Is he couldn't defend himself in the presence of both the king and Esther. Because if he was speaking only to the king, so he could have explained that his plan to kill the Jews was justified. And he could have made some of the same arguments that he made before, that, okay, Esther's one of them, but these Jews, they're Mefuzer and Mefora, the same arguments that they're scattered, they don't do any good, they don't observe the king's laws, and Ahasuerus has been able to be convinced by others before, and particularly was able to be convinced by Haman or Memuchan before. So why don't you just say that? So the Malbim understands that he could have said that if he was able to be alone with Ahasuerus, but he couldn't say that in front of Esther. You know, if they're both there, it's not going to help things if he says that in front of her. And if he was just speaking to Esther, so he could have explained that he didn't know that she was Jewish. But it would still undermine his case to Ahasuerus about why they should destroy the Jews. So because they were both there, he couldn't appeal to both of them. And that's why it says that Nivas Nilvnei HaMelech Malcha, that Haman trembled before cringe before the king and the queen, because he really had no defense. If he's saying how bad Esther's people are, so Esther's right there, it's not going to help. If he tries to say that he didn't know, so you know, that's not going to that's not going to help placate the king, because still he was manipulative, and that's not going to change things. Just the fact that he didn't know that Esther was part of this nation that he tried to manipulate the king to destroy. And then we have a very dramatic continuation. That Ahasuerus in his fury leaves for the palace garden. And then when Haman is alone with Esther, he starts to plead with her. And then Ahasuerus comes back from the garden to the feast. The Haman nofel alamita sher Esther alel. And Haman is falling on the couch that Esther was sitting on. Vayomer HaMelech, and the king said, Agam lichvosh ez hamalka imi bevayis. Are you also going to force the queen with me in the house? And that was the end. Adavar yotzem epi HaMelech ufnei Haman chafu. That the word came out of the king's mouth, and they covered Haman's face. So why was Haman just falling on Esther? You think he'd be very careful. So the Medrash says that the angel Michal began cutting saplings before him and adding fury to his fury, and he pushed Haman onto Esther while she was crying. And then she says, Adoni HaMelech, Arehu Kovsheni Lefanecha. Look, Haman, I mean, she, Esther thought, you know, Haman just, you know, going on top of her. So she calls out, and that was able to provoke the anger and reaction from Ahasuerus that, you know, in heaven that they wanted. That's why the angel Michal was involved in facilitating this. So you see another example of a divine providence orchestrating these different events. It says that they covered his face. So that was the Ibn Ezra. That was apparently the protocol of Persian kings, that when the king was angry with someone, they would go and cover his face. I guess you don't want to look at someone you're angry with. So if you're the king, I'll just cover his face. I don't want to see him. And he says that was known in the Persian records. That was the custom. And then you have Carvona. So the pasuk says in 16, "Vayomer Carvona echad min asarisim lifnei amelech." And then while this is all going on, one of the king's chamberlains spoke before the king. His gam he near eats asher asa Haman leMordechai asher diber tov al amelech. The gallows that Haman made for Mordechai, who spoke well of the king, standing in Haman's house, 50 cubits high. And the king says, "Tluhu alav, go hang him on it." So it's in a good timing. And you imagine Haman isn't so happy with Carvona. Oh, by the way, you know those gallows? Go and hang him on it. So where did Carvona, who was Carvona? Where did he come from? Why did he have this piece of advice to give? So Carvona was, I know Judith says, like, Carvona, you don't even go here. Like, why are you like meddling in with this? Yeah. But what's Carvona doing? Who is he? And why is he giving this advice? So Carvona was listed as one of the king's advisors in the first chapter. So that's who Carvona was. And you see, he was one of the sarisim, one of the chamberlains of the king. And he was actually, according to the Gemara, he was actually not a good guy. In number 17, the Gemara said that what happened to Carvona? So Carvona, the Gemara says that he was a rasha. And when he saw, and he was also an opportunist, that when he saw, when he saw that his counsel hadn't been fulfilled, miyad barach, he ran away and he distanced himself. That's essentially what was happening here. That Carvona, up until now, was on Team Haman. He was one of the advisors. He was a supporter. He had no regard for what would happen to the Jewish people. But now that he sees that, oh, wait, it's not going to be so good to be on Team Haman, so he ran away figuratively. And the sports is from a pasuk in Iyov, "Vayishlech alav velo velo yachmol miyado varoach yivrach." They will cast upon him and not have mercy, from his hand he will flee. So it shows that, you know, bad guys aren't always so loyal to each other. They're bad guys to other people, they're bad guys to you. And he saw that the Haman's plan wasn't working out, so immediately he switched teams. And that's why he was so firm. He wanted to distance himself from being in the circles of Haman. And that's why he suggested right away to hang Haman on the gallows that he built for Mordechai. But we say in Carvona Zachor Latov. So why are we singing about Carvona? So according to the Medrash, it wasn't really Carvona who popped on the scene and gave this piece of advice. Rather, it was Eliyahu HaNavi, who is Nidbe LeCharvona, that he appeared like Carvona, and then gave this advice that Achashverosh should hang Haman on the gallows that he prepared for Mordechai. So this was another way that Kadosh Baruch Hu was involved in orchestrating these events. That immediately when the tables turned, so that was really Eliyahu HaNavi, who was presenting himself like one of the king's chamberlains, who gave this advice. And that's why we say, Carvona Zachor Latov, not necessarily the Carvona, one of the king's chamberlains, is Zachor Latov, that he was a great guy, but the Eliyahu HaNavi, and we refer to many places, particularly in the Gemara, Eliyahu HaNavi Zachor Latov, that Eliyahu HaNavi is remembered for good. So we acknowledge that here, that Eliyahu HaNavi, who presented himself like Carvona, should be remembered for good. And then the chapter closes, again, this whole downfall of Haman, from being the closest advisor to the king at an exclusive party to being sentenced to death, is all in 10 verses. So the pasuk says, "Ve'yislas Haman ala eitz." They hanged Haman on the gallows, asher echin leMordechai, that he prepared for Mordechai, the Chamas HaMelech Shachacha, and the king's anger abated. So the Gemara notes that Shachacha, it should be Shachach, it uses the two chafs here. So Shtei Shlichos Halalu Lama, why are there two abatings of the anger? So it says, two angers abated. So we see here the real turning point, that the anger of the Malkus Shel Olam, the king of the universe, was abated because the Jewish people were for some time not in good standing with the Ribbono Shel Olam. The fact that in the times of Nebuchadnezzar and times of Daniel, that the people were bowing towards a statue, whether it was idolatry or not, but in general, they, on a whole, were not acting the way they should. They were going to the feast of Achashverosh. But at this point, Hashem saw that the people's behavior had changed, that they did tshuva, they fasted, they davened. And it was at this point that the anger of the king of the world was abated. And then we see that from this point on, despite the fact that the Jews have to then defend themselves, but from this point on, the tables had turned, and Mordechai was on top, Haman was on bottom, and that's really the turning point, that when the Jewish people reversed their ways and made a earnest attempt to return to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in kind, Hashem returned to them, and any difficulty in the relationship that existed was calmed down, the anger was abated. And just in these moments, the Jewish people went from being destined for annihilation to being raised up and glorified among those who wanted to destroy them. So you see that this is really how things change. You're going to have the plan for destruction. Everything looks negative, but then We turn our ways around and then we try to come close, and then any anger that the king of the universe has will be abated, and then the tables will turn and we can be raised up.